the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 233. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your lawyerly host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Good. Are you feeling lawyerly today?
I am feeling lawyerly. I've got my powdered wig on, and I am ready.
Isn't that barristery, or is that still what they call it? Solicitous.
I couldn't say solicitous. That would have a different connotation.
And that's why I said it.
There you go.
All right. Well, a little bit of news.
A few things happened this week.
Trifle of news. Just a modicum of news. We've got Yodel Mountain. We've got yodeling for you. And, of course, we've also got to talk about a really frustrating and disturbing power grab in Wisconsin. The Republicans are doing everything they can to minimize the power of the incoming governor and more. So we'll talk about that. And then we'll round it out with a quick little Andrew Was Wrong segment. Those are, personal favorite.
Your favorite, my least favorite segments. But we gotta hold me accountable. And I was gonna call
TTTBE the Thomas Was Wrong segment, but yeah, I guess it's only 40% of the time.
Statistically speaking, that is a Thomas Was Right segment, right? If we are rounding up to the nearest whole integer, you are at 1.0. You're at 100%.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Now I feel like a clown horn. Andrew, you're rarely wrong. You cover so much, and then you're wrong about tiny little things that people correct. And actually, I joke, but people send really nice, helpful emails, you know, when we get little stuff wrong here or there, and it's it is appreciated. So
no, I love it. I mean, we cracked the joke here. We have a bunch of new listeners, and just in the interests of full disclosure, I'm the one who puts Andrew Was Wrong on the schedule, right? Like, yeah. I love that segment. Yeah,
it would be pretty funny if you didn't even want to do it, and I was like constantly just trying to research. Guys, tell me when Andrew Was Wrong. I'll add it in the show.
No, I love it, and I want to. It's a good opportunity to emphasize the thing that you and I, particularly me, that I have tried to say from way back in episode one, right? Which is, I never ever want this show to be, oh, X is this way because Andrew said it was that way, right?
Like, right.
That's not the whole goal here. Is, you know, to bring legal education to a non-law audience. And so I get stuff wrong. I try and be really, really upfront about where my experience lies, where my education goes. And I love that people are out there ready to let me know when I've made a mistake. Seriously, I enjoy learning from the show, and it's part of the lesson is that, it's about us all bringing to bear, you know, skepticism and critical thinking and everything else. And so, so I'm a fan of the segment. So anyway, with that out of the way.
Yeah. And a little teaser for you. We might be having a new segment, not this episode, but, you know, it might have something to do with Yodel Mountain remembering stuff. Oh, so we'll see. Andrew is making us do it on Tuesday. As much as it's like when the kids want to open the presents on Christmas Eve, and it's like, no, you know, it really would be more appropriate to do it on Christmas morning. And you're like, you're right, but I wish you weren't right. No, it makes more sense to do it on Tuesday's episode, since we don't do Yodel Mountain usually on Tuesdays. So let's look forward to that.
This is a steaming hot cup of hot cocoa with little marshmallows in it on Christmas morning. This segment is so good, and I am so excited about it, and I can't wait for everybody to get there. So if you like the show, make sure you listen on Tuesday.
All right, enough of that. Let's get to the real Yodel Mountain. Everybody start your yodelers.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay, so Andrew, you had kind of a interesting thing happen around you that you were going to tell a story about. I'm curious to hear about this.
Yeah, I had an incredible experience literally this morning, and it filled me sort of with equal parts of hope and despair. And I thought that it overlapped exactly with what we're doing here on Yodel Mountain. So so I wanted to share with you. I was at an event that was a bunch of Maryland business owners who were getting together. And, you know, I do these all the time in connection with my day job, in connection with the firm. And I've talked about this before, and I've talked about how I use that to sort of gauge where folks in the business community are about the Trump administration, right? Because I think part of what is so insidious about what Donald Trump has done is normalizing the behavior coming out of that White House. And every time I see something that either entrenches that or contradicts it, it catches my eye. So here's what happened. A friend of mine was talking in a group, say 12 business owners all hanging out at the water cooler. And this person mentioned that they were thinking about attending a conference overseas. And it seemed kind of, it was a long trip and everything else. And so somebody asked, hey, you know, why are you going to do this for this, you know, conference that seems kind of detached? And this person looked at the group and paused for a second and then figured, okay, well, I'm among friends. I'm going to be honest here, and said, I'm Jewish. And really for the past year and a half, I mean, you know, you look at, you have neo-Nazi rallies in Charlottesville. You've got a synagogue getting shot up in Pittsburgh. I want to know how feasible is it if I have to evacuate my family, right? What could I replicate my business overseas? And we were all kind of taken aback and, you know, sort of stunned by that. And the analogy that this person used was, if the and again, with a level of self-awareness, but you know, this person said, you know, Jews in Nazi Germany in 1935 got out. In 1938, they didn't get out. So, you know, am I being alarmist? Am I jumping the gun? Maybe, but is it something that I think about? Yes. Is it something that other Jewish business owners that I talk to think about? It is. Is it something where I've had conversations where friends of mine are not putting up Hanukkah decorations this holiday season? It is. And it really, I mean, kind of, you know, again, this was a couple of hours ago as of when we're recording, and it knocked us all back a little bit.
Yeah.
And I didn't, I mean, it, you know, it really sort of, you know, drove home, I think the position of privilege of of those of us still in the room, and I was really of two minds about it. I mean, number one, obviously, you know, sort of aghast that, you know, this is what somebody is talking about in the United States. But the flip side, what was really interesting to me was we sort of went around the circle and people were, you know, rightfully kind of pausing to take it in. And then another person who owns pretty good sized company said, yeah, you know, my dad is from Scotland. And so we have under Scottish law the ability to get dual citizenship. And yeah, we started that application process. And then somebody wow. else said, yeah, I got earlier in 2018, I got dual citizenship in Canada because my grandmother is from Canada. And what struck me was...
Are their reasons the same or different?
No, none. Right. Again, these were, you know, people that didn't, you know, were just, you know, did not, you know, we're not Jewish. We're not, you know, we're white people, right? Privileged white business owners who have it good in Donald Trump's America, and breaking that ice and getting out there. You know, the reaction was not, oh, well, you know, you're, oh, how could, you know, the reaction was, yeah, you know, this hits all of us differently, but yeah, we're thinking about it. Right. Mm. And different people are thinking about it in different ways. And I thought, and to me, that was the right. You know, you have a glass half empty. It's not hard to describe that part. But the glass half full part of it was, you know, maybe if people around you have been quiet, and there's a lot of like, yeah, I'm just sick of talking about politics. And I totally get that. Even among listeners to our show. Right. I get that. But I thought, I mean, here was somebody that sort of, you know, took a risk in a professional conservative business setting, and I think it went over. And so I would just say, you know, that if you don't know and you've been thinking about it, that having those conversations and starting to get people to realize and vocalize and discuss that this isn't okay, this isn't normal, right? This isn't blue versus red. This isn't, oh, we're, this is really not the way politics in America should be. This is qualitatively different than the complaining and I'll tell you, you know, I was out there on the front lines complaining about, you know, George W. Bush when he was president. It's different, right? And people around feel differently about it. So why it struck me.
I totally see why that affected you. And just couple thoughts. I cannot at all relate to the, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to grow up Jewish and, you know, especially the Holocaust and World War II were a minute ago in cosmic time. You know, it's really, it's the stories are still alive and well in many families and all that. And I can't imagine how that might be different to be raised with that in your cultural memory and an immediate family memory oftentimes. So that's really just amazing to think about from that perspective. And can you blame somebody for being alarmed at a time like this? You know, I just saw, I wasn't planning to talk about it, so I don't have the exact quotes or anything, but I just saw Fox Business clip shared around that's just this naked anti-Semitism about George Soros, you know? So like it's in the popular media. It's not on the fringes anymore when it comes to the right wing. And it's, you know, so it does seem shocking and like, oh, you gotta be exaggerating. It's not, you know, but can you really blame somebody with that in their family and cultural history being a little worried right now?
I had a client. I don't know. If you knew, maybe I was the last person and my naivete and optimism, but I had a client explain to me the three parenthesis thing. I don't know if you're.
Oh, yeah, I do know what that is. Yeah, that's a really
I would like to never know that. Like, I would like, by the way, and for our listeners, if you don't, right, that is used by white supremacists to indicate that the person on the inside of the triple parenthesis is Jewish. I'd like to not know white supremacist neo-Nazi code words, right?
Yeah, and but I'll go just because it's something I know about. I'll take a second on the further detail that would be something that white supremacists, you know, just awful alt writers would tag. So like if they saw somebody they identified as Jewish, and it might have even been Ashkenazi, I don't know if it was more specific than that, but Jewish, they would reply with those three parentheses on each side. And because of these people are always very adept internet users, these, you know, these 4chan a-holes and these dark web weirdos, that would somehow be a way that they would search it out. I don't know. It might have been just a basic Twitter search, but either way, they would search that out, and then they would flood that person's mentions with horrible anti-Semitic crap, you know, just thousands and thousands of them. And so that's why if you've been on Twitter and you saw a lot of people change their username to be that, or their display name, it was actually a solidarity thing. They figured if everybody did it, and I didn't know about this at the time, or I might have. It's been a few years, I think, since that started. But they figured if everybody changed their name to be that, then it would make it way harder for these people to harass and target people. So that's if you've ever wondered about that and didn't know, that's what that is.
Yeah, I didn't know. I had a client who, again, sort of without identifying, called me up because there were comments left on this person's website that, you know, use the triple parenthesis, and, you know, and I had to do the whole lawyer thing. Okay, well, tell me. And then, you know, this person walked me through the history of that, and it was just, I had no idea, and, you know, would love to live in an America in which I could continue to have no idea. Anyway.
Well, and speaking of that, I was going to say one final quick thought, which is, if America means anything, which maybe it doesn't, but maybe it should, if America means anything, it should mean not being afraid to set out your holiday decorations for whatever religion you might be, assuming it's a peaceful, you know, like, assuming it's not some murderous cult or something, but like, that should be what America is, the religious freedom to celebrate Hanukkah or celebrate Christmas or celebrate anything. And so it's embarrassing to think, as a country, that's the attitude that we're allowing to exist, or that's the kind of the fear we're allowing to take hold. Yeah. So
no, I couldn't agree more. And when I get the question, and I get this question from business professionals on the right and activists on the far left who tell me, why are you doing Yodel Mountain? Why are you trying to bring down Trump? Why do you care? Mike Pence is worse. And that's my answer, right? I do not believe it. And again, maybe, you know, it's possible for me to be disappointed and surprised on the low end. I do not believe that in a Mike Pence administration, we would have neo-Nazi rally. I do not believe that the fascistic trends from Donald Trump would have been in place had Mike Pence been the Republican nominee and won outright. Look, I I don't think I need to persuade any of our listeners that I don't agree with anything Mike Pence has done in his entire life, right? Like, I disagree with literally everything Mike Pence has ever done, ever, including drinking a glass of water, right?
Including looking like a senator who's about to take away rights from mutants in X-Men.
Yeah, exactly. No, he is, right? Senator Kelly from X-Men. Yeah. That's he's the guy. I get that. But to me, you know, that's the difference, right? That it is.
Yeah.
It
well,
is
the, I was going to say flippantly, prepare to be disappointed. But I don't think, for example, I don't think we'd have the BS right now with the Khashoggi, with Trump siding with the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. I don't think that would be the kind of thing that would happen in a Pence presence. Personally, I think that's a very specific to Trump and his weird personality that he's doing that. Like even all the Republicans in the Senate are like, what is happening with this? Anyway, we should probably get to the Yodel Mountain story.
Let me do 8 more seconds on defending Mike Pence. Mike Pence is one of the sponsors, right, under Obama, of the Journalist Protection Act that would have extended the privilege to journalists to protect their confidential sources, right? So whatever, and again, right, maybe some of that was political grandstanding against Obama for the James Risen thing. I don't know, and I don't care. I do not believe that Mike Pence would have perpetuated this idea that the press is the enemy, would have these farcical White House press conferences, you know, would have revoked Jim Acosta's press pass for asking hostile questions. Like, none of that, I think, would have been there. So anyway, so that's part of why we do Yodel Mountain. And and why don't we go there?
Yeah, let's start. Yeah. OK, real yodeling now, actual yodeling. We got to talk about the news. There's a lot happening. Flynn, who we all kind of forgot existed. who I always think looks like the Muppet, the Eagle Muppet, you know, doesn't he look
Eddie
like
the Eagle, Eddie the Eagle. Yeah.
He really looks like that guy. But when the news started breaking, people on Twitter that I were following, that I follow were saying, yeah, this could be a product of, remember Flynn, everybody, he's been pretty quiet and, turns out it's quiet to us, but maybe not so quiet to, Mueller. So, talk about the Flynn story and his cooperation, possibly.
Yeah. So Michael Flynn entered into a plea deal, was one of the very first plea bargains with Mueller's team. He pled guilty to one count of 18 U.S.C. 1001A, which is making materially false statements to the FBI. As a result of that plea deal, we've talked about how the U.S. sentencing guidelines give you the matrix, and the matrix gives him, you know, we talked about how Paul Manafort was a 37 and is now going to be a 43. That made Flynn a 4. And so a 4 with no prior criminal history is an advisory guideline range of 0 to 6 months. And then in connection with that, the government then has to file a memorandum telling the judge what the government's position is with respect to that range, right? And again, as we've pointed out, the sentencing guidelines were made advisory by a Supreme Court opinion. So the government could say, hey, look, we know the guidelines say 0 to 6 months, but, you know, we think this guy should be in jail for 2 years, right? They're free to do that. It requires kind of a heightened standard to try and persuade the judge to deviate from the sentencing guidelines. But the government can do that. Flynn is scheduled to be sentenced on December 18th, so a little under 2 weeks from today. And the government filed its memorandum and said, we don't think Flynn should do any time at all. And that's what's really interesting, because there were essentially two memoranda that were filed. The first was the memoranda that is largely unredacted, okay? It is 6 pages long, and it says, notwithstanding the fact that Michael Flynn committed serious crimes, that he cooperated early and often with the Mueller investigation, and even though we think this is a very, very serious crime, because of his substantial cooperation, we want him to not face any jail time whatsoever. And I want to point out, again, this is a smart prosecutor who has no intention of being handcuffed by this later on. So, for example, right, the sentencing memorandum says the defendant's history and characteristics present mitigating and aggravating circumstances, right? This is somebody who is well prepared for somebody like a Paul Manafort, you know, playing you along and then bailing. There is nothing in these memoranda that is going to turn around and hurt Mueller with respect to any other witness, whether they've cooperated, whether they don't, whether Mueller wants to put him away forever or whether Mueller wants to be lenient. It's very, very smart. Attached to that is a shorter 5-page memorandum that details the specifics of Flynn's assistance. And everything that has not been publicly disclosed is redacted.
This led to some jokes. There's a lot of redaction.
It's led to some great jokes. I like the one that superimposed page 2, which is 2/3 of it are just redacted black lines over, you know, and it sort of kind of looks like a black and white version of the Stars and Stripes. it was turned into an American flag. I like that meme. But there are things that we can learn even from the redactions. And now, I say learn. Some things are total supposition. So you follow the opening arguments Twitter feed, you will see I recreated the memo in Microsoft Word and the redacted section of there's a redacted criminal investigation and the part that is blacked out is exactly the same length. There was somebody else who also measured it in pixels, by the way. Wow. It's exactly the same length as President Donald J. Trump. Okay. And I will point out that was the first thing I typed in, right? I was prepared to try three or four different things. President Donald J. Trump, because that's how he's referred to earlier in the memorandum. It fits exactly. Okay. Now that
I was actually going to ask, like, do they literally just do the redaction on the document, or are they ever like, we better kind of throw people off the scent. Let's put in a bunch of space that wasn't there. I was actually going to ask that, but I thought it was a stupid question, but maybe not. Maybe they should do that.
It's a great question. The answer to that is there are no countermeasures that are employed in redaction. And the reason is because lawyers are an incredibly conservative by temperament profession. And so this is left over from the days. I will tell you, I have personally done this, in which documents were redacted by applying tape over them and photocopying, right? Like now, you just scan it in, you use Microsoft Word, you use the bold, cover block black 100% opaque send to front, but I've actually redacted documents in my young legal career with tape, and and so that practice continues. And so what you do is, right, you cover up the words with tape that you have hidden from the publicly available version, and if you over redact, that's actually grounds for sanctions. So no, there's no, throwing someone off the scent by redacting more than you need to. All of that is something, and I want to be super clear, and I was super clear on Twitter, right? Like, the fact that it's the same language, I think somebody replied back, getting the spirit of what we were saying, that said, it's also the same length as, Tony Stark is Iron Man, right? Like, look, there are a lot of things that could be the same.
But I kind of think the probability that they're indicting Tony Stark as Iron Man is a little lower than President Donald J. Trump.
Yeah,
given
it is,
the relevancy
but it's all and I want to be totally clear, because that's what we try and do here. But here are the things that we do know, right? From the unredacted text. Beginning on page one, Mueller says that Flynn has assisted in three ongoing investigations. And those three investigations are listed as a criminal investigation, blah, 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 redacted, right? The special counsel's office investigation concerning any links or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald J. Trump, which is left unredacted, and which, as we pointed out in last week's episode, these are the first round of filings in which Mueller has explicitly said, yes, we have evidence linking Russian interference in the 2016 election with the Trump campaign, right? That allegation was not made in the Manafort trial and is being made now, and it's significant that was unredacted. It's significant that Mueller filed this without referring to Trump as, person one or defendant one or, so that's the second item in the list, which causes you to ask the question, gosh, what's under that redaction tape that you would list it ahead of Russian influence on, in connection with the Trump campaign? And then after the comma, there's a third thing that everything is redacted under that, right? So there is a third separate investigation, the details of which we do not have, that is separate from the links between Russian efforts to hack the 2016 and subvert the 2016 presidential election and the Trump campaign. There's still a third thing, right? You could speculate as to what that might be, right? It might be family members. It might be bribery. It might be corruption. Yeah, it might be, you know, something wholly unrelated, right? I do not want to suggest that it must be related to the Trump administration, but I do want to say there is a third thing that has not dropped yet. So that's kind of the first thing. That's the summary on page one. And then beginning on page two is when Mueller then details, says, okay, Flynn was helpful on these three things. Blank, connections
Tony
between
Stark
Russia
Iron Man.
And Trump.
He was
right.
Key in identifying the secret identity of Iron Man.
Right. And blank. And so then we get to see the details. And under A,
we do?
Right?
Do we though?
Yeah.
Do we really?
That's where we get literally. It says A, blank criminal investigation. The defendant has provided substantial assistance in a criminal investigation, and then everything else is redacted. It's about a page worth of information spread between pages two and three. Then we get B, the special counsel office's investigation, which is redacted, which tells us nothing new, right? It just says that it reiterates subpoint one is interaction between the transition team and Russia, and part of that is blocked out. And then it says the defendant also provided useful information concerning, and then a page worth of information is blacked out. And then after that, even the header for subsection C is redacted. And obviously all the information under it. So subsection A, they blacked out whose criminal investigation it is. Subsection C, and I haven't seen anybody else talk about this because if you don't know how lawyers write, you don't get to see the next indented subheading. And so it looks like it's just, it's all part of B, but there is a C. There's a C point under there. I'm 100% confident of this because lawyers would not say you helped us in these three areas and then go subpoint A, subpoint B, bleh, right? Like they would absolutely put the third subpoint C in there. Nobody has picked up on this as far as I've seen. So that entire line is also blocked out, even including the header. So there is not a second shoe, but a third shoe that will drop. The other thing we learn from the sentencing memorandum is that Michael Flynn has met with Mueller and his team and provided documents on 19 separate occasions.
Wow.
So if you're trying to read the tea leaves, when somebody meets with prosecutors, I have never seen, and again, I've been tangentially involved in white-collar criminal investigations that were handled by my firm. I have never seen a cooperating witness meet 19 times with the prosecutors, right? That is extensive, total, complete cooperation, and that's significant. So there we go.
Whew. All right. So there's some judge somewhere who knows all this now, I guess. Like who gets to see this?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. This filing is redacted as far as it is available to the public, i.e. to me, over Pacer, which is how I got these documents. But the unredacted copy has been filed in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia before Judge Emmett G. Sullivan, who is a Clinton appointee to the federal bench. He was appointed in 1994. He is 71 years old, obviously a Democrat, well-respected judge, not somebody I have practiced in front of. So I've never had a case in front of him, but he is the third longest serving judge on the United States District
Look,
Court.
Look, we all have his baseball card, his trading card. You're just reading from the back of the
right.
thing. Yeah, that
he had
stats.
He had a 325 on base percentage last year. Being made
yeah,
up
but
for
the
it
point
by,
is, the only thing I was pointing out is it's funny that there's one guy now who's like, yeah. holy moly, and he can't even tell anybody
yeah.
about it.
He knows, and he cannot tell even his closest friends. Yeah, that guy, I would love to be Emmett G. Sullivan's college drinking buddy, because I got to tell you, he and I would be playing a lot of poker over the holidays. And
he's in the judge's break room, just like shaking, drinking his coffee. Everyone's like, "What's with Emmett G. Sullivan?" Everybody, he's like, "I can't talk about it."
Yeah.
Bullet point C.
He knows.
Bullet
he
point
knows.
C. Or whatever you said. Yeah. Sub point C. He knows that Tony Stark is Iron Man. Okay, let's see. We've got more news. We've got Stone pleading the fifth. That's a good sign usually, right? That means nothing. You're not doing anything wrong, and nor yep. is anybody you know doing anything wrong, right?
Yep. And this is, as we have said, I believe I would wager any amount of OA's money that Roger Stone is about to be indicted. This letter was released by Dianne Feinstein on December 3rd, so a couple days ago. And in it, through counsel, his counsel is Grant J. Smith, not somebody I know. But in it, the attorneys for Roger Stone say that he is going to decline to produce documents requested by the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's going to decline for a bunch of reasons. There's claims of overbreadth, overreaching, too wide ranging. By the way, those are all synonyms for each other. That you don't have to say that. You could just say overbreadth. But at the end, it is made clear that Mr. Stone is invoking his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. There is nothing to add here other than the Fifth Amendment does allow you to refuse to produce documents. Part of the interesting aspect of Fifth Amendment law, we touched on this with, for example, Apple's face recognition software on the iPhone X. But what it means is, your privilege against self-incrimination means that you have the right not to testify against yourself, not to voluntarily produce documents that could be used to incriminate you, not to voluntarily produce physical evidence that could be used to incriminate you. So, in other words, if the police say, hey, we want you to unlock your phone, you can say, no, I'm not going to do that, and I plead the fifth, right? I don't want to go sort of too far down the rabbit trail, because this is an interesting and unsettled area of law as to what else qualifies as testimonial, right? What else allows you to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege? It's a really fascinating area of law. It needs its own segment. But voluntarily giving Dianne Feinstein documents certainly falls under that category. This is not surprising. And Roger Stone's about to be indicted. So that's why he did that.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah, exactly.
oh my gosh! Finally, this is my favorite bit of news in the last, I don't know, however long since last week. Rudy Giuliani was hacked on Twitter by the deep state liberals. I don't know if this is exactly Yodel Mountain material, but it's just the best.
Yeah. This is my favorite. So you know this story?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. I can tell. So Rudy Giuliani accidentally did the thing that I do constantly on my stupid phone, which is the space bar button like doesn't work for some reason. Like you hit it and it doesn't register. And I do this all the time when I'm messaging like my brother or whatever.
I will point out from the Q&A as an Apple user, like my space bar works just fine. But anyway,
okay, all right, big shot. Okay, all right, with your Apple phone. I admit it might be an Android problem. Could be. And by that I mean I'm an Android and I have a problem with typing. And so if you don't leave the space in there, if you don't put the space in there between sentences, you accidentally can do something dot something else, because of the period. And so Rudy Giuliani accidentally did that on the tweet. And so someone quick thinking, like very some enterprising individual with very fast hands and website registration skills, grabbed that URL, you know, which, by the way, we also, the unsung hero of this might be the fact that, you know, some years ago, they allowed you to grab any, you know, it wasn't just .com and .gov. They opened that up to like everything, right? So because of that, they were able to register a website that had whatever ., you know.
So the tweet is, Mueller filed an indictment just as the president left for G-20 in July.
Oh, right, yeah.
So it's
G-20.in. Yeah. So they register that. And it points to, you know, a website that says like Donald Trump is a some anti-Trump thing. And so now Giuliani, because he's the embodiment of that meme you see where it's like behind every millennial who can't afford housing or afford living, above them is a baby boomer who doesn't know how to open a PDF. You know, you see that meme from time to time, being the perfect embodiment of that. Giuliani is now convinced that this is a deep state conspiracy to hack his Twitter or something. He did a follow-up tweet.
The follow-up tweet says, the same thing, period, no space, occurred later and it didn't happen, right? So in other words, you click on this G-20.in and it takes you to a page that says Donald J. Trump is a traitor to our country, right?
Yeah.
And so the Giuliani's like, well, then I stuck in the period, right? And it didn't happen. Don't tell me. This is exact quote. Don't tell me they are not committed card-carrying anti-Trumpers. Fairness, please.
Oh, my God. It's so good.
And
I like that he was scientific about it. Hold on. Let me do an experiment. Let me not put, let me put the space in there. And now all of a sudden my tweet hasn't been hacked. Ergo, it must be a deep state conspiracy.
Yeah. I want to add two things to this story. One funny and one sobering. They both fall into the same category. Rudy Giuliani is Donald Trump's cybersecurity advisor.
Oh my.
The firm that he runs, you could do this. I will link this in the show notes.
Oh, wow.
www.giulianisecurity.com.
Oh, okay? My God.
And that is Giuliani Security and Safety. And when you click on the About page, it tells you that they are a
It has the construction thing where it's the like construction guy and it's like website under construction.
No, they are a full service security investigative and crisis management consulting firm. So he has a cybersecurity firm.
All they do, by the way, is they proofread and don't put they make sure you put spaces in your tweets. Like that's the one cybersecurity. By the way, this isn't I don't need to say this. Nothing has been hacked. They made it so they just made the link that he accidentally put in his tweet lead to something. It doesn't. Yeah. Oh my God, this is unbelievable. And, that's so funny.
And again, we're laughing about this, but the sobering part that I want to remind people of is there is a contingent in this country that believes that Hillary Clinton raped and murdered children in the basement of a pizza parlor that does not have a basement. A guy showed up with a loaded assault rifle at Comet Ping Pong, which is 25 miles. I've driven past it and showed up with a loaded assault rifle demanding that they release children from the basement of this building, which, again, I want to remind you, does not have a basement. So the fact that Giuliani has tweeted out this insane conspiracy theory means that there are now probably, I'm going to estimate conservatively, a million plus people who believe that Time magazine hacked Rudy Giuliani's tweets to make him look like an idiot. That's the America we live in. So congratulations and start your...
It's still funny, though. I mean, that is scary. You're right, still so funny. His response, too, like not even, it would have been funny enough, you know, when I just saw the first tweet and it was like, OK, someone got him, you know, whatever. People make typos. And then him having no idea what it is. Oh, man. Good times.
Good times.
Well, that was a good again. Yes, you're right that we should all be scared to death every day that these are the people who are running our country. But it's also funny.
Yes.
not strictly Yodel related. So, all right, with that, again, it's one of those, transition down Yodel Mountain segments to kind of take us into the next segment here, because it's time to talk about this Wisconsin business. And actually, today's, as of recording, daily episode was also on this, but I think we're going to do way better than they do because, you know, it's Andrew. So, Andrew, tell us about this Wisconsin power grab.
Yeah. We might call this segment, we might call this episode, elections don't have consequences. Here's what's happening. Look, here's the top line of what everybody in the media is reporting. Which
I figured we were just going to call it redacted, by the way. Yeah, like it was just going to be.
Yeah, that's
it. Is there a way to do that? Like, just black out the title? Anyway.
Mainstream media is reporting that in a lame duck session, the Republican Congress, with the active collaboration of outgoing Republican Governor Scott Walker, is handcuffing the incoming powers of Wisconsin's new Democratic governor. And that reporting, I am distraught to tell you, is 100% accurate, right? That is a correct description of what this is meant to do. And I want to tell you exactly what they have done, because this will be a blueprint going forward. This is going to entangle the state of Wisconsin in lawsuits for pretty much the entirety of the next governor's term. And there's a really, really insidious aspect of these bills that that nobody has really reported on. So let's get ready to break all that down. The two bills. So there are a series of bills that begin with Senate Bill 883. They are combined in final form into Senate Bill 887. But they went through the legislature. That the two most significant were 884 and 886. I will give all these links in the show notes. Here's what they did. But I guess before I do that, I want you to take a look, click on them. SB 884 had 29 specific topics, right? The bill is over 200 pages long.
Okay? Wow.
SB 886 had 14 specific topics. It is 50-odd pages long. These bills were not created. I know how bills get generated by legislative staffers. They absolutely were not drafted in the past week. They were not drafted in the past month. This is a I am 100% certain that the Republican legislature in Wisconsin has been working on this as a contingency plan for what happens if they lose the state house. Now, what has happened? These bills have passed. They will be signed by Scott Walker, who is we have long detailed the fact that he is not remotely concerned with anything other than preserving Republican power and conservative political outcomes in the state of Wisconsin. They have passed on a straight party line vote. Some Democrats were not present, but zero Democrats have voted for these bills. A handful of Republicans have voted against these bills. I could delve down and talk about the specifics. Maybe we'll do that in a later episode. There were a handful of fringe Republicans that didn't go along with this. Broadly speaking, here's what the bills do. And this is why I think they're going to be a model for Republicans going forward. In states that have a gerrymandered state legislature, and we have a ton of these because of Red Map in 2010 that was very, very successful at flipping a lot. And Wisconsin is a blue state, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, went for Trump in 2016. It had not gone for a Republican since Ronald Reagan's landslide in 1984. Before then, it's a rock-ribbed blue state. Nevertheless, the Wisconsin State House is gerrymandered to favor Republicans. Other blue states, other purple states are like this. And here's what these bills do. Broadly speaking, they cripple the governors' incoming executive agencies, including the attorney general, which is a separate elected position in Wisconsin. And again, a Democrat was elected in the midterms. And they take powers that were traditionally associated with those executive agencies and pull them back and require consent of the legislature. So, for example, Bill 884 eliminates the position of Solicitor General and his three deputies and reassigns that power. So Solicitor General is the state's highest lawyer that argues in favor of the state when the state is sued, right? Analogous to Noel Francisco, the U.S. Solicitor General. People have asked sort of what's the difference between the Attorney General and the Solicitor General. The difference is, right, the Attorney General is the nation's chief legal officer, makes strategic policy decisions. That is, you know, was Jeff Sessions, is now Winona. The Solicitor General is the person who does the oral arguments, the person who writes the briefs, the person who appears in court. It's now, with the passage of this bill, that person, those supporting individuals, will no longer be appointed by the governor. They will be appointed by the legislature. And if you're asking yourself, in any state in the union, does the legislature appoint the person who of Solicitor General? The answer to that is no. This is utterly unprecedented. It's never happened in any state before ever.
Wow.
And literally, it reflects the fact that Republicans don't like that the voters elected a Democrat as Attorney General. And so they took away the power of the Attorney General to appoint the Solicitor General and his deputies. Continuing with the judiciary, they changed the power, right? So some states have a requirement that when you make an allegation that a statute is unconstitutional or preempted by federal law, you would have to serve the Attorney General's office, right? And the reason that you do that is because you're taking a state law claim, and those are the bases for litigating that case in federal court. This bill changes that requirement so that, I try and call out when this is a both sides do this kind of thing. This has never been done in any state in the history of the Republic. Now, those notices will be served on the legislature. And you might be asking yourself, what does the legislature have to do with overseeing when the state defends itself in federal court? And the answer is not a single clown horn thing. Never. It's not part of their job. It's not part of their oversight. It's not part of checks and balances. You won't find it in the Federalist Papers. This is taking power away from the Attorney General because the incoming Attorney General is a Democrat. What else? The bill prevents the incoming governor from renominating anybody for an appointment who has been voted down by the Wisconsin State Senate. That changes the existing law, which allowed, after a period of time, the governor could go back and nominate somebody again. Cannot be nominated for any other office. Once they vote that person down, they're out. Places a tremendous club in the hands. And by the way, the incoming Republican state legislature in Wisconsin is not just Republican, but overwhelmingly Republican. Presently, it's 2-1. The new session is 1.75-1. So they will absolutely be able to gridlock all of the incoming governor's appointments. And once the governor puts somebody up, it's one strike and you're out, thanks to this bill. I'm not remotely close to being done here. So you want to talk about some of the indefensible things that, again, I don't see this being reported everywhere. There's an agency called the National Economic Development Corporation, right? Lots of states have this. It's designed to be a public-private partnership to encourage enterprise within the state, right? Existing NEDC is split 6-6, right? It's a 12-member body. 6 members appointed by the governor, 6 members appointed by the legislature. The new bill changes that to 4 members appointed by the governor, 3 members appointed by the legislature, 3 members appointed by the Speaker of the House of House of Delegates, and 2 appointed by the minority leader. So if you're counting, right, that's 4 from the governor, 6 from the Republican Congress, and 2 from the Democrats in Congress. And by the way, those latter appointments are not no longer serve at the pleasure of the governor. So in other words, cannot be dismissed out by the governor. So the governor will not be able to change the composition of the NEDC in Wisconsin. Next, the legislature added a requirement that they can request that before any executive agency does anything, they can request an independent financial analysis for any rule that any agency proposes to make. So if you think about how that can tie up the state in unbelievable bureaucratic red tape and unnecessary financial costs, that means before you do anything, any member of the Republican legislature can request that agency prepare an economic analysis and have to go through that entire rigmarole. That is obviously going to be used as a delaying tactic. I could keep going on about, and all of these provisions are in 884. It gets worse. Because of course it gets worse. 886 is a poison pill that is designed to make sure that the next Democratic governor of Wisconsin cannot fix the emerging healthcare crisis in Wisconsin. It is loaded. I call this a poison pill bill. It is loaded with provisions that are designed to prevent the governor from doing anything. And let's talk specific in the area of healthcare, and let's talk specifically about what that is. So, number one, no executive agency, including Health and Human Services in Wisconsin, may submit a request for a renewal, a modification, a withdrawal, a suspension, a termination of a waiver of a federal law or rule for any pilot program without consent of the legislature, which is to say they can't do it at all, right? Because the legislature is just going to continue to block that. What is all that pilot program stuff? What that means is that when our next president, Elizabeth Warren, is sworn in January of 2021, as part of the efforts to rehabilitate the Republican attack on Obamacare, the Warren administration will introduce a whole bunch of new pilot programs to try and expand out Obamacare back to the states and repair some of the damage that's been done over the past couple of years. This bill will prevent the Democratic governor of Wisconsin from adopting and participating in any of those programs without the consent of the legislature. It's going to leave the Democratic governor with zero accomplishments in the area of health care. The bill also requires that I had to look up that the governor implement badger care reform, which, by the way, you know, because of the Wisconsin badgers, right, whatever. This is Scott Walker's successful effort to gut the state's Medicaid, to make it harder to apply and to be on Medicaid. And so if you think about expanding Medicaid, which is what Democratic governors have typically done, it is urgently needed in the state of Wisconsin. The incoming governor will not be able to do that. They will be, as of right now, prohibited by law under the terms of this bill.
What does this have to do with badgers?
Because Wisconsin is the badger state. So
Oh, Badger. I thought you were literally saying, like, in with all this stuff, they snuck in something not, about Badger care.
What it means is anyone who receives Medicaid will be thrown into a pit angry badgers. It's part of the new law. That was the euphemism for Scott Walker's efforts to make it harder for people to qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
This bill, 886, is loaded with poison pills that are designed to prevent the incoming governor from changing the horrendous right-wing policies that were put into place that the voters just voted out, right? And so the net result, and I'm truly terrified of this. So the net result is that Tony Evers, the Democrat who defeated Scott Walker, right? Scott Walker was on the ballot. He was running for re-election. The voters of the state of Wisconsin had the ability to say, do we want these policies put into place? And they overwhelmingly said, no, get out. We want Evers in here. And he will not be able to reverse at the executive agency level the changes that that Walker put into place. And as a result, it would not shock me if in 2 years, Evers is not a popular governor in Wisconsin. People are going to be grumbling. They're going to say, you ran on X, you ran on Y. Why do we still have these problems? Why is there so much bureaucracy? Why is that? Why is that? And the answer is because these bills put into place are going to prevent him from having accomplishments, are going to prevent him from doing the things that the voters of the state of Wisconsin want. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see him be a one-term governor and have a Republican get elected in 2022 entirely on the basis of what the Republicans have done right now. It is.
Is this all, but you, this is going to pass constitutional muster?
So
this is all, you think these will go through?
The arguments against. So I started to delve into this question. The arguments against this are going to be rooted in separation of powers. I would like to do a deeper dive. I think we will do a deeper dive. The state of Wisconsin is going to be embroiled in litigation for all of 2019. There is no doubt in my mind because it strikes me on face. Again, I don't know the history and case law of the state of Wisconsin. I tried to learn as much as I could for the segment. It strikes me on face that there is a very, very good argument that this arrogates to the legislative branch powers to which it is not entitled. And
I
we'll
would
say,
think,
yeah,
at least on a few of the points.
Yep. But the question is, right, how long does it take to build up that factual record? How quickly can we get review by the Wisconsin Supreme Court? And whether they're able on some bizarre collateral issue. Look, like that's going to require very, very smart and good lawyering. Fortunately, I know some good lawyers in the state of Wisconsin. But it's going to require very smart and good lawyering to keep this out of the Supreme Court to make sure that it poses no U.S. constitutional issues. We're going to keep our eye on it. So the next time somebody tells you that Republicans are the party of eliminating bureaucracy, reducing waste, and keeping costs low, point to these bills in Wisconsin because they most certainly are not.
Wow, this is depressing.
Yeah, it's worse. It's worse than it's being reported. I mean, I went into this hoping that I could say, "Oh, look, like you know, this is a it's an alarmist, right?" You know, and no, it's not. Like it is meant in a way that is hard to explain to the average person to completely handcuff the powers of the incoming governor to do the thing that governors always do, right? And the thing that Donald Trump has done at the federal level, right? Like what Donald Trump has been able to do is not, you know, he's passed one law, right? He's mostly been able to staff executive agencies to undo what Obama has done by staffing executive agencies, right? That's just what electing a new executive means. And what these bills would do is prevent Tony Evers from substantially changing executive agencies to match the will of the people. It's truly frightening. And again, we don't need to say this, but I'm going to say it. I would be opposed, right? Maryland had the chance to do this, right, in 2012, right? We had a Democratic outgoing governor. We had a wildly, overwhelmingly majoritarian Democratic state legislature and an incoming Republican governor in Larry Hogan. And if the Maryland legislature had done this, I would be up in arms about it. I would be outraged. It is absolutely improper, violation of the traditional notion of separation of powers. It makes the state less democratic. It's a terrible thing, whoever's doing it. It just so happens the only people doing this are Republicans.
Ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is one of those, sometimes we go back and forth on the like, well, should Democrats kind of use the same tactics because otherwise they're going to lose out? This is one of those where I agree with you where it's like, no, this just shouldn't be done. No, we gotta stop this. We shouldn't also do it. All right. We are way over time here, so I think we'll have to, we got to make sure we get to your quick Andrew was wrong segment, but we'll have to leave it there with Wisconsin. I'm glad that Scott Walker finally has a good ending to his campaign pitch, which, if you remember back when he was campaigning for president, was, look, everyone hates me so much. I was recalled several times, but I was able, but I pushed through, and now I can say I was actually just beaten. I'm no longer, it's good. It was funny that in his own campaign talk, it was about how everybody hated him and didn't want him to be governor. But he's
and he was running against Ted Cruz. I mean,
yeah. All right.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, Andrew, quick notes. What were you wrong about?
I was wrong about two things. So, number one, and a couple of people sent this, but I'm gonna give first shout out to Chris.
To me, he said, "Are you sure about this?" At the time,
on OA230, I said that Julian Assange is not a hacker. And a bunch of folks wrote in to say that actually he worked for Sun Microsystems and that he is considered a hacker and that, in fact, I was linked to and I watched a couple minutes of a YouTube video that was at a hacker con that was by a big person in the hacker community who talked about, you know, catching up with his buddy Julian Assange and them reminiscing on the hacker days. So I had multiple sources that told me that he wasn't. The note even says, also, every biography news brief slash article gets his backstory completely wrong, so don't feel too bad. So I don't feel too bad. I did check that claim out, but
he is an a-hole convinced. We're not correcting right. That that's still
he is a clown horn. I said he was not a hacker, and I was just wrong on that. So thanks, Chris, and thanks, others.
Yeah, play the tape. I think your co-host was like, really? He's not a hacker? Are
yeah,
you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. But nevertheless.
Yeah, you did. And so thanks, Chris. Thanks, Thomas.
All right. Item two.
Yep. Ronnie Moe writes in to say that when we talked about too much meat in OA 231, I mischaracterized in kind of an offhanded parenthetical clause the underlying nature of the paddlefish lawsuit, and I said that that the paddlefish were being illegally imported, and I was thinking across state lines, but nevertheless I got it totally wrong. So I'm going to read what Ronnie said, which takes a pretty good swipe at me, but it's funny, so I'm going to allow it. He says, "I believe that American paddlefish, being natives of the Mississippi River, were probably not illegally imported, as claimed in the latest OA episode. Obviously, if Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana are foreign countries, I will gladly admit my mistake. You also forgot the caviar." Thanks, Ronnie. It was not illegal importation across state boundaries. It was, in fact, that the American paddlefish is a protected species, so the fishermen were charged with illegally fishing a protected species. It's kind of a neat, like, sting operation. there was an undercover agent that infiltrated the fishing. It's a fun story. Again, it was linked in our original episode. I only spent about a tenth of a second on it, but on the description of that case, because I was using it as the segue to talk about, you know, gross rubber prophylactics. But I mistakenly used the word illegally imported when I meant illegally fished. So thanks, Ronnie. I'm suitably chastened, and Andrew was wrong.
Yeah, this isn't opening fish arguments. Like, we don't know.
Stay tuned for our new podcast, Opening Fish.
Angling arguments. This is
angling. I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Thank you. Thank you. Spinoff podcast coming at you 2019. Okay. Anything else, or is that the end of your wrongness?
No, that's it. I was right about literally
every other thing. All right. Awesome. It is time for our co-favorite segment of the week, and that is Top Patron, Hall of Fame Patron Friday. And we begin with, this is, of course, those who have pledged. There's a number of the people ask questions. You have to be there at least a month, and you have to be at least at the $5 level and up, and that's at patreon.com/law.
Yeah, and the reason we make you wait a month is because if you're a new patron, even at the $5 level, you're going to get a new patron shout out, right? And so we didn't want to have, you know, just the same names being repeated all the time. So we had a lot of new patrons. If you're a new patron at the $5 level, you're going to get your new patron shout out this month, and then you're going to get your weekly $5 sponsorship shout out once you've been in for a month. So thank you for supporting, and here we go.
And here we go. McKinney ISD is run by bigoted dominionists. Hey, Andrew, this is a good one. How do you know someone went to Harvard?
I don't know.
They tell you. They tell you. they tell you. That's a good joke. I like that. Does Andrew know Ted Cruz, or just the guy whose skin Ted Cruz is wearing?
I don't know.
That's good. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderbeck, Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia at gsowteam.org. What if Trump requested asylum while visiting a foreign country? Monica, Mastel & Company, the Registry Matters podcast. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Abacus Finch, never going to give you up, never going to let you down. Advocate for a foster child in your community. CasaForChildren.org. Karaoke legend Cosmo Blues, now appearing at the Lakumi Bar. DataHeck.com. Business automation, making the menial automatic. That's awesome, DataHeck. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Trump, the plump grump, fell on a frump stump and got a dumped lump on... I don't know, it ended. It trailed off. Blank Boxman, rest in peace, Astrid the Halfling Swashbuckler. Kurt Robinson, Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU 3L. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Yodely McYodelface, there are very fine people on both sides of TTTVE gate. Rest just, oh gosh, someone just pulling a prank on old Thomas here. Rex just run to Gustafson. Some German impossible.
Is this another
word.
East European name with six Z's and two X's in it?
I think they probably just picked the most complicated. Either it's just a series of letters that make no sense, or they picked like the most complicated German word ever. Russian hacker drop table patrons. Good old sequel humor. The other Michael Cohen. Sam Buck. Seriously, please tell me how to get around the 66 character limit. I don't know. It's just, you just have to work within it, I think. Unless somebody, are people getting around it? Getting Off Podcast. Zabby, join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Dalen Lee Samus Grix. Starry Decisis from the Top Rope Brother. Polly Chalk. Mike the Intactivist. Call 831-CAT-LAW-1 to talk to Law Cat Buttercup today. Anonymous. Rob Schreck, James, Seattle selects Eric Carlson 2021. Hey, go ahead. I can't even believe how not well Erik Karlsson has played for the Sharks. It's unbelievable. I could take him or leave him at this point. I don't even care. Take him. Seattle, new NHL team. Don't know if you know that, Andrew. They're getting a new team next year.
I did not know that.
Brian Upshaw's last chance for profit prison. And finally, opening arguments is way better than this stupid podcast. I don't know if that's meant for somebody else's patron, but I like it. Like maybe they also pledge to another podcast. That's great.
I hope that person pledges to every single podcast out there, right? I mean, And thank you, too. You say Conrad Michaels is top patron, but after TTTB, how can we trust anything you tally? Ooh. Boy, that's rough. I will tell you, we'll get an independent auditor to verify this. Conrad Michaels
already
is
done.
Far
it's
and away
done.
Our top patron. Attorney Genital Whitaker, vote democratically for a Democrat to preserve democracy. Wigged Hitch Runt, not so much a defense, more a plea of YOLO contender. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Just 3 weeks to Christmas, up your pledge in December for poor podcasters. Hey, that's good advice. Serious Philosophers Opening Shoe Shine. That is the whole universe there. I like that. 43.5 Gross Rubber Prophylactics Need a New Law Dog. A Reiki Forest Healer. That's R-A-K-E-Y. Yeah. I like that. This one weird trick will keep Thomas from passing the bar exam. Probably. Poutin, Putin, Poutine. Love poutine. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Saul, Big Easy Blasphemy, An Anagram of Roger Stone is Regret Soon. Yes, it is.
Nice.
A String of Unpronounceable Characters. Mr. Torres, are you a claimant of or representing the tacos and scotch? Yes. Michael Cohen is my favorite celebrity attorney. Andrew is a close second. Fair. Brandon Smith, Malika Chandler, I would donate more, but it's raining outside. Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Worth every penny to make Aaron say, Jolushku Tunai Fenta Hovalis. Sam Danow, Teresa, Greg Sullivan, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, Matthew Vernon, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Aaron Grady, Mitt Romney is spineless and won't stand up for anything, sorry. In an Alley, St. Muller, Patron Saint of Yodelers, Sakashite Fukusumi, Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, waiting on Conrad's credit card to expire in order to gain some ground. No, that will never happen. I like how that was apparently the target this week.
Nice.
Then this one, the text is blacked out, must be Michael Flynn's sentencing memo. That is a fantastic,
very,
timely name.
Very on point.
Mormon J. Fox, who has had the number two spot for a long time, and that is still an outstanding reference. I always giggle. And our top patron, you know who it is. He's gotten two shout-outs already, but there are not enough shout-outs in the world for Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much.
All right, and now it's time to see if this improbable two-question streak can increase to three, right? Isn't that what I'm on?
Yeah.
Wow. We'll see. TTTBE, I think.
All right.
104. 104.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Thomas. A woman who is a computer expert decided to educate herself to exposing persons who trafficked in child pornography. She posted a number of sexually oriented photographs on her website. The file for each photograph contained an embedded Trojan horse program, a program that would allow the woman to enter the computer of anyone.
I'm
going to
need Rudy Giuliani's help on this one.
Yeah, right. A man downloaded one of the photographs onto his personal computer. Using the embedded program, the woman entered the man's computer and found a file containing a pornographic photograph of a child. She copied the file and turned it over to a federal law enforcement agency. A federal agent told her that a successful prosecution would require more than one photograph and offered her a monetary reward for additional photographs leading to the man's conviction. The woman entered the man's computer again, and this time she found hundreds of child pornography photographs, which she turned over to the federal agency. The man was charged with multiple counts of violating federal child pornography statutes. He moved to suppress the photographs that the woman discovered on his computer. The motion is based on both the Fourth Amendment and a federal statute forbidding interception of electronic communication without permission. The parties have stipulated that the woman's conduct in downloading photographs from the man's computer violated the interception statute. So, how should the court rule on the defendant's motion to suppress?
Oh, that's tough.
Yeah. A, deny the motion as to all photographs, B, grant the motion as to all photographs because the woman acted without probable cause, C, grant the motion as to all photographs because the woman violated the federal interception statute, or D, grant the motion only as to the second set of photographs.
Wow, what a weird one. Let's see. It really would seem to me, as much as, you know, the facts of this question would love us to be, not on the side of the pedophile, it really seems like this shouldn't be how the law works. Like, people just investigate each other and break, violate your constitutional rights, and then the police can use that to prosecute you. I would hope that that's, yes, we would want it to work in the case of this pedophile. However, I think it would be a bad legal precedent to set. So I don't, I'm way leaning toward a grant the motion. So, but this is weird. As far as the logic of the answers, I'm not 100% sure yet. So let's go through them. A, deny the motion to all photographs. I'm going to go ahead and say it's not A because I'm leaning toward granting the motion, because it really, I don't feel like this can be how the law works, but we'll see. B, grant the motion as to all photographs because the woman acted without probable cause. I don't know. Does probable cause apply to citizens, I wonder? So is it okay if I think, if I have probable cause to believe you have something on your computer, Andrew? I don't feel like that gives me any right. It might give me the police the right to do something. I don't think it gives me any rights. I can't be like, probable cause, so I'm allowed to go hack into your computer using this cunning Rudy Giuliani-esque technique. I kind of don't think B. C, grant the motion as to all photographs because the woman violated the federal interception statute. I was anticipating there's going to be some trickiness with the Fourth Amendment versus the statute, because the motion is based, it goes out of its way here to say the motion is based on both the Fourth Amendment and a federal statute forbidding interception of electronic communication without permission. That's interesting. Is it even a communication? It's just she's stealing the photos. However, we learn here, it's important to read the next sentence, the parties have stipulated that the woman's conduct in downloading the photograph from the man's computer violated the interception statute. So I guess I don't need to worry about that. I don't need to waste mental energy on that because they're stipulating it. And finally, D, grant the motion as to the second set of photographs. That's interesting. So is there some distinction between when the woman hacked into the computer for the first one, and then is it different when the federal agent told her to go get more? Now, is that different? If anything, for some reason, it feels like it should be different the other way. It feels like if a federal agent tells you to do something, it should be more permissible. However, on the other hand, I could almost see an argument that if something falls into the lap of the a federal agent, hold on, turned it over to federal agent. I could almost see it. Now, this is hard. I think I'm eliminating A and B. I'm leaning towards C, but I actually could see a decent argument for D. Hold on a sec. He's moved to suppress federal statute. Stipulated. I could almost see an argument for D because the first photograph is like, if a bag full of evidence is left at the police station, I feel like they can kind of just use it. Because as for the first photograph, it's all the woman did all of that on her own without the police. And then the second batch of photographs is kind of directed at the direction of federal agents, which that makes sense that federal agents can't just tell you to go break the law and get evidence. So, gosh, I could almost see D. However, maybe this federal statute is a red herring. Maybe it's more important that we look at the Fourth Amendment, because the Fourth Amendment is what would matter here, because we're talking about police. We're not really, I don't know. C, grant the motion is all the photographs because the woman violated the federal interception statute. I feel like, though, if that logic is right, if the logic of C about the statute is right, then, of course, that applies to all the photographs. It doesn't just apply to the first one or the second one. Oh, man, this is really hard. Do I need to go to my sacred coin, or should I try to die? I don't want people to not give me credit, so I guess I better, you know, live or die on my own mental coin that I'm going to have to flip here. I think I'm going to try to not trip myself up too much. This could be wrong. I'm a little worried that this is going to be one of those ones that actually is tricky and complex, but in general, I feel like the odds are more often it is my instinct. You know, I'm 60-ish percent, 59%. So I'm going to go with C, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's D, but I might just be overthinking it. So C, final answer, eliminating A and B, but I'm going with C.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and we will shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Well, bit of a marathon episode unintentionally. But hey, you know, that's we love you guys. So
that's what we do.
Marathon episode for everybody. Thank you so much for listening. And keep on hacking Rudy Giuliani, deep state liberals. keep doing what you do best. And we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission. 43.5 Gross Rubber Prophylactics.